Welcome to this new podcast from 5RB Barristers' Chambers, specialising in media and communications law. This is the second of two episodes about how to seek and defend an interim injunction. In the first part, we explored what needed to be done up to the hearing. In this part, we'll look at what takes place at the hearing and in the aftermath. I'm Desmond Brown QC, and to explore the issues, I'm once again joined by two colleagues, Alexandra Marzek and Adam Speaker. To remind listeners about the facts we've been discussing, a solicitor had called up and said that she's been rung by the agent of a well-known TV presenter who we called Karen. She'd been called because a press photographer had been taking photographs of Karen walking in a local park earlier that day. That wouldn't have been unusual, except that on this occasion, Karen was with her young daughter in a buggy and also with her new boyfriend. Karen separated from her husband, but still married, and a reporter from one of the nationals has called the agent and told her that they're planning to publish a story about Karen's new love affair. She assumes that the story is based on the pictures taken in the park that day. Now, Karen has applied for an interim injunction. She's ticked all the boxes, produced witness statements, draft order, application notice, claim form, and even an explanatory note. The court's been informed, a judge is lined up, skeleton arguments may have been exchanged if time allows. What happens next?
First, we need to bear in mind that the hearing, if it's urgent and convened at very short notice, might be taking place out of hours. If so, it's not likely to be in a courtroom with the usual facilities. It could be in any convenient place, such as a conference room in chambers, or on the telephone, or even in a judge's kitchen. One or both sides may not have a solicitor present in such circumstances, and that might give rise to practical issues. Someone needs to take a note of the hearing and of the judgment. That applies in all cases, but is particularly important in applications made without notice. Where the hearing is not in a courtroom, it might be a good idea to ask the judge for permission to record the hearing and judgment. Whether or not permission to record is given, those present need to ensure that a record is kept, however informal the setting.
Now, that's all the practical arrangements taken care of. What happens next?
At the hearing, the first thing to raise with the judge is usually whether the application should be heard in private. This is fairly standard in this kind of application where the information itself is said to be private, and therefore to identify the parties and facts about them would defeat the object of the application because that would frustrate the administration of justice. That said, all derogations from open justice must be convincingly established on evidence, and the court will scrutinise the application and look to impose the least restrictive orders possible. The starting point is the guidance set out in the Master of the Rolls practice guidance on interim non-disclosure orders, which sets out the court's approach to applications that potentially derogate from open justice.
It's essential to make the application for a private hearing at the outset, before any information has been communicated in open court. This is because it's not usually possible to put the genie back in the bottle. Where the cause of action is misuse of private information, and the factual information is private, not simply a photograph, say, the courts tend to accept that a first instance hearing is difficult to conduct in open court. They will usually still give a public judgment, but it may be redacted and anonymised.
Now, on this question of open court or not, there have been some recent decisions, haven't there?
There have. The Supreme Court looked at this whole area of reporting restrictions in Kuja and Times newspapers, where an individual was named in court in the context of a criminal trial involving accusations of sexual abuse, in which he had been investigated but never charged. The Supreme Court held by a majority that the open justice principle overrode his rights to privacy because he had already been named in open court.
And that was the point I was making earlier about it not usually being possible to put the genie back in the bottle. There have also been three very recent first instance decisions that are helpful. Two involve right to be forgotten claims against Google, which are due to commence in February, where the court has been grappling with how to allow claims to be heard in open court whilst not revealing the identities of the claimants. In the third, Khan and Khan, Mr Justice Nicklin discharged an anonymity order made by a master in a harassment claim. He explained, and I quote, "In most harassment claims, the disclosure of private information in open court is simply an incidence of the litigation, and that is no different from any other civil case. But unlike privacy claims, in most harassment claims, there is normally no risk that the administration of justice will be frustrated by the proceedings being heard in open court.
So even though time may be short, it's obviously crucial to think carefully about how to conduct the case, safeguarding the claimant's interests while at the same time having proper regard to open justice. Now, once the judge has decided whether or not to hear the matter in private, what's the next step?
Since the application is one to restrain publication and therefore engages the defendant's right to freedom of expression, the test applied comes from Section 12(3) of the Human Rights Act, which states, and I'm quoting, "No such relief is to be granted so as to restrain publication before trial unless the court is satisfied that the applicant is likely to establish that publication should not be allowed."
The House of Lords explained Section 12(3) in a case called Cream Holdings and Banerjee. It explained that it normally means that success at trial must be shown to be more likely than not. As Mr. Justice Warby put it in YXB and TNO, in some cases it may be just to grant an injunction where the prospects of success fall short of this standard, but ordinarily a claimant must show that he will probably succeed at trial, and the court will have to form a view of the merits on the evidence available to it at the time of the interim application.
Alex, is Karen's case one where the lower standard might be appropriate?
No, I can't see anything out of the ordinary on these facts that would justify a court applying a lower standard. There's nothing to suggest that the damage that would be caused by publication would be particularly severe to Karen or to anyone else, for instance.
What's next, Adam?
Well, after the preliminary matters have been addressed, the court hears the submissions from the applicant. They will be targeted at persuading the court why, on the evidence which is in writing on an interim application, that the test for an injunction has been made out. That exercise is largely evaluative. It broadly involves two questions. Can the applicant persuade the court that in respect to the disclosed facts, she has a reasonable expectation of privacy in the particular circumstances of the case? Or has the defendant done enough to cast doubt on whether Karen will succeed at trial on this issue? If so, that's the end of the matter. And second, if Article 8 is engaged and Karen does have a reasonable expectation of privacy, since the newspaper wishes to exercise its freedom of expression, whose right has to give way to the other?
Now, is that second test what's sometimes called the public interest test?
Yes, but although the phrase the public interest test is still widely used, it's also known as the balancing exercise in the context of misuse of private information. The key consideration is whether publication of the information in question would contribute to a debate of general interest, such as to justify the publication of what would otherwise be private information. The Strasbourg court has said it's necessary to look at the contribution the information would make to public discourse, also to look at how well known the person concerned is, to look at her prior conduct towards the press, or what's often described as correcting the record. One looks at the method of obtaining the information and its veracity and the content, form and the consequences of publication.
What evidence would a defendant need to assemble?
Well, it depends on the case, but often there's very little time before a hearing, and the only evidence the defendant will be able to put together, if anything, is likely to be past media reports or cuttings, as they're known in the trade, showing that the claimant courts publicity and has discussed her private life in the past, for instance. In other cases, there could be evidence that a third party wants to discuss his or her relationship with the claimant or put the contentious information into the public domain, and therefore the rights of the third party will come into play.
Another important factor for the newspaper to consider is what it intends to publish. Very often it will have a draft article containing the contentious information, and it will need to take a decision whether or not to share that draft article with the court. There may be cases, rare cases, where it would be helpful to do so. For example, if the article is a sober piece of investigative journalism, which is obviously in the public interest. However, it's generally a bad idea to share draft articles. No publisher wants a judge micromanaging editorial content. It's usually better to have the argument based on principles.
Well, then once the court has considered those questions, it needs to be satisfied that Section 12(3) as interpreted in Green Holdings is met.
Yes, indeed. Where the hearing is without notice, the applicant needs to bear in mind the duty to give full and fair and accurate disclosure of all relevant material and ensure that the court's attention is drawn to all relevant legal principles. In an application for an order of this kind, that includes drawing the judge's attention to Section 12(3), as you say. If the court is not satisfied that Karen has shown that she's likely to succeed at trial in establishing that the publication of the information will be a misuse of her private information, then the application should be rejected.
Where both rights are engaged, as here, a balancing exercise has to be conducted. It's been explained in cases such as Ries and Campbell and PJS that neither a right to privacy nor a right to freedom of expression has priority or preference over the other. And the court has to apply what's called an intense focus on the comparative importance of the rights being claimed in the individual case. Ultimately, it's a matter of proportionality.
Are there other arguments available to a defendant?
Yes, a defendant might argue that the claim for privacy is really a defamation case in disguise, and that would require a higher test for an injunction. Or a defendant might argue there's been material non-disclosure, or perhaps that an award of damages would be sufficient in the case. An injunction is always a discretionary remedy.
Judges have to decide these matters very quickly, don't they? Adam, you'll recall that in Brevan, Howard and Reuters, which you and I acted for the claimant last year, Mr. Justice Popperwell heard argument on an application for an interim injunction for breach of confidence over a whole day, and then gave judgment first thing the next morning, which Lord Justice Longmore on the appeal in the Court of Appeal thought was very impressive.
Yes, he did, and that is because Reuters wanted to publish imminently. It all depends on the time frame for publication. If the hearing is on a Saturday evening for publication the next day, the judge may well have to indicate what decision he or she has arrived at, even if reasons are provided later.
If the injunction is successful, who draws up the order?
Well, as with most applications, it's the applicant's or claimant's counsel will draw up an order reflecting what was decided and agree it or try to agree it with the defendant's counsel for sending to the judge for approval and then later for sealing. The claimant's solicitor will then need to arrange for it to be personally served on the defendant.
What considerations go to whether it should be served on others as well?
Well, the spycatcher principle operates in this area. Third parties who are served with an interim injunction are on notice of it and are bound by it. That is to ensure that the administration of justice is not interfered with and means that a claimant will be able to obtain a worthwhile remedy at the end of the process. But if a third party is served with the order, the court will be concerned to ensure that it is kept in the picture and is updated on the progress of the action. It means that any third party served with the order may also need to be sent all the relevant papers, unless there's a contrary order to that effect. That means providing the third party with a note of the hearing, with the judgment, and with the relevant evidence. The fact that a claimant needs to send the papers to third parties served with the order may be a factor in deciding who needs to be served with the order.
And as we discussed in the first part, a third party who's notified may well seek to challenge the order themselves. This is why they need to have all the relevant papers.
Now, a claimant will always be concerned, obviously, about costs. What does the court do about costs?
Well, it depends. Under American Cyanamed, the general rule is costs reserved because the court does not look at the merits and is only holding the ring until trial. Because the courts do have to look at the merits on an injunction of this kind, the costs sometimes follow the event.
A claimant is obviously usually very happy to have the injunction, but isn't there a danger that she'll sit on it?
Yes, it's important for a claimant to appreciate that the claim is going to continue, since any interim injunction is of course only temporary and, as Adam says, only holds the ring until trial. Where there's been a hearing without notice, or perhaps at very short notice, there'll need to be a return date so that the issue of the need for an interim order can be decided upon proper consideration of both sides' cases. A claimant needs to ensure that there's a provision for a return date, and she can't treat her interim injunction as if it were a permanent order. There's still a need for the claimant to proceed with the case and prove her claim at trial if the matter doesn't settle. This is something the courts have recently become a lot stricter about.
Is the situation the same if the application is unsuccessful?
Yes, if the application is unsuccessful, the claim proceeds, although in practice most claimants abandon a claim where an injunction application fails.
Appeals from injunction decisions tend to be quite common in this area, aren't they?
Yes, the Court of Appeal seems keen to hear these kind of cases, which is another factor for a claimant to appreciate when she starts her claim.
On appeals, if an appellant can identify an error of law, then that is, of course, important. Otherwise, the courts have said that because the exercise is evaluative, similar to a discretionary decision which requires a party to overcome a high threshold on appeal. However, it's certainly true that judges disagree when it comes to freedom of expression cases, hence the number of appeals.
To take an example, in Naomi Campbell's case, the judge found for the claimant, a unanimous Court of Appeal overturned him, and then, to my discomfort, because I was acting for the defendants, the House of Lords overturned the Court of Appeal 3-2.
Well, more to your comfort, in PJS, Cranston J refused an injunction. The Court of Appeal overturned him and granted one. The Court of Appeal then decided to discharge its grant of an injunction because it found that the information was publicly available. And the Supreme Court, by a 4-1 majority, reimposed an injunction.
And what about OPO, in which Mr Justice Bean dismissed the application for an injunction, the Court of Appeal unanimously overturned him, and the Supreme Court unanimously overturned the Court of Appeal?
Well, we could go on and on like this. Similar situations occurred in both Jameel and Flood, to take just two defamation claims.
Indeed.
Finally, the issue I want to deal with is how to conclude a privacy injunction application. If an injunction is granted and the parties then come to settlement, how do you go about the formalities of concluding it?
By an agreed order, often a Tomlin order. But the crucial issue in these kind of cases is how to ensure that any private matters remain private beyond the conclusion of the case. This requires an order of the court. There's a useful short judgment by Mr. Justice Warby in the PJS litigation, where he dealt with an application on paper to extend the derogations from open justice in circumstances where the injunction remained in place.
Well, that brings us to the end of our second episode dealing with interim injunctions involving freedom of expression. My great thanks to Alex Marzek and to Adam Speaker, and for further information on the cases we've been talking about, I do recommend visiting the 5RB website at www.5rb.com.